good morning. Good morning.
Hey, hey.
You know, this is, we're going to celebrate the destruction of New Orleans. They started tearing down houses today.
We're going to celebrate it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, mourn for it. We have a second line of our own. First of all, I should tell people you're listening to KBOO 90.7 on the FM dial. It is talk radio with me, Joe Uris, and my bud, Abe Proctor. And, you know, the number to call is 231-8187. And, New Orleans, man.
Yeah. This just in.
This just in?
The president lied.
The president
lied! No, I'm serious!
No, you must be kidding!
No,
the president's
true.
A liar, dog. How could it be?
Well, last week, the Associated Press released some...
The Dissociated Press?
No, the Associated Press.
Oh, the Associated Press.
Released a video
tape. They should
be
out. They should call themselves a Dissociated Press.
They should.
Criminal dissociation.
Whoever they are, they put out a videotape, okay?
Okay. A videotape.
Here's what that videotape showed.
All right.
The president in a room in his ranch in Texas, being briefed by his highest-ranking domestic advisors.
He probably couldn't hear because he was cutting brush.
No, he put down the chainsaw and the tequila for a moment, and he sat in this room.
Yeah.
And by video conference, he had Michael Chertoff, head of Homeland Security, and he also had Michael Brown, head of the Federal Emergency Management
Agency. Michael Brown, beat him round.
Right.
Yeah.
And a number of other high-ranking experts. And they said to him a number of very dire things regarding the imminent landfall of Hurricane Katrina, which happened the next day after this briefing.
I'll say that the day before Katrina hit.
And one of the things that he was warned about repeatedly. Was the possibility, indeed the probability, that the levees surrounding the city would be breached in one or more places. Then, as I'm sure you'll recall, 4 days after the hurricane hit, Bush went before television cameras and said, "I don't think anyone could have predicted or anticipated the breach of the levees."
That's not funny at all, is it, really?
No, it's not funny. You know what else isn't funny?
What?
Do you know how many questions he asked during this videotaped briefing session?
Let me guess. 7.
No, he didn't ask a single question to any one of these advisors.
Well, he's not a curious man.
No, he's not a curious man.
He's a curious George, but not a curious man.
And he assured state and local authorities that the federal government would be prepared in its response to the hurricane.
And they believed him?
I don't know if they believed him or not, but that's what he said. And, you know, I think for a large swath of the American electorate, that's enough. But I think the people in the Gulf region were a little bit skeptical about that pledge.
Well, and, you know, his numbers are down.
Yeah, way down.
Way down. I have a question. I don't know if you know the answer to this. Are his numbers, of course, how long have they been doing numbers? And how accurate are their surveys? Are his numbers lower or as low or slightly higher than any other previous president at any other given time?
They're just about as low as anybody except for Nixon at this point in his second term.
Nixon. This was when Nixon was getting ready to resign.
Yeah. I believe presidential poll numbers, I believe that started under FDR.
Ah.
If memory serves.
So the sat fat rates, as they used to call them,
right.
Satisfaction
right,
rates.
Right, right.
So in fact, the... this guy has lower numbers or as low numbers as Richard, I am not a crook, Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, but we don't have a parliamentary system, so we can't vote him out through the act of the parliament or Congress.
No, we cannot.
We're stuck with him for another 3 years. Almost.
We are.
Yeah, 3 years, almost. And meanwhile, he's doing incalculable damage.
Yeah, on almost every front. About in every conceivable policy arena, he is doing incalculable damage.
Basically, moving all the money of the United States, public and private, out of the hands of ordinary people and into the hands of that top one-tenth of one-tenth of 1%
of
Americans.
And at the end of last week, he asked Congress for the line item veto, which, as you recall, a Republican Congress gave to President Clinton.
Right.
And it was later taken away from him by the Supreme Court.
Right.
Bush says his version is constitutionally acceptable, and he says he's going to use it to curtail excess spending. But we know what that means.
Well, what is that?
He's going to strike those line items from the budget that help the poor, that bolster public education, that enforce environmental and labor regulations. He's going to cut these line items from the budget. He's going to leave in place everything that benefits his class of donors.
Well,
he's going to do it in the name of reducing the deficit.
Well, that he created.
But
you know what I like best of all is he goes to India and he gives away the store. Now we've had a non-proliferation arrangement treaty around the world, pretty much, which kind of limits how much nuclear technology and stuff you give to nations, because you don't want to put them in the position where they can easily make nukes.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue about the fairness of this. Why should why should there be a nuclear club, which is what officially China, Great Britain, France, United States, Israel?
Well, they're not officially part of the club.
Well, they're not officially part. India
and Pakistan.
Pakistan. Yeah. Okay. Now, but at any rate, the nuclear club has kind of held the balance here because they're big powers and presumably more mature. I don't know. But anyway, now what he is doing with India is creating a center of rivalry in terms of potential nuclear weapons in Asia. And he's doing this, I personally think, just because the nuclear industry needs new customers.
I think it's to establish an alliance with India against China in what is emerging as the new Cold War.
You mean we're going to go back to that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're going to go back to.
So we'll all have Titan sphincters as we talk about mutually assured destruction?
Yeah, that's right. China is right now the United States' chief economic rival, and we still think in terms of needing to have economic rivalries. So they are economic rival. And, of course, they are a nuclear state. And they are a centralized economy, although not to the extent that the former Soviet Union was. And they were, of course, our economic rival of the Cold War period.
So, in fact, the Chinese have a very effective economy. What they don't have is personal freedom.
Right, exactly.
I mean, they have an incredibly powerful economic engine.
Yeah. So you could say that what's been a unipolar world since 1989 is beginning to polarize once again, and the pole that sits opposite officially to the West, is headed by the United States, is China.
So the fly in this ointment is still the fact that there are these angry terrorists.
Yeah.
But we've taken care of them by having a war in Iraq.
Right. The flypaper theory.
Yeah. Which we are losing.
Right.
Oh, no, we're winning in Iraq. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
And it's the only reason we're losing is because there's people back here who are dissenting.
Yeah. Speaking of dissenting, there's going to be big marches. What is that?
A couple weekends from now, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to have people on about that. But, oh, man, I get so depressed. But there's good things coming, though. We're going to be saving lives very shortly.
How's that?
Well, South Dakota.
Oh, right.
South Dakota. You know this.
Uh-huh.
South Dakota has, in its vast governance wisdom, decided to make it impossible, legally speaking, of course it won't make it not happen, for women to have safe and sane and legal abortions. And they're going to do this to save the lives of every little fetus they possibly can.
That's right.
And they're doing this in the interest of humanity. Now, what's also interesting about South Dakota is that they don't give much money to child care and health care for babies and so on, or mother, postnatal care or any of that. But they do, until you're out of the womb, you're going to be protected.
Your priority number one.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is designed directly to go to the new Supreme Court. The new, I'm not going to tell you how I vote, says Mr. Roberts, Supreme Court.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that, Judge Alito.
Yeah, those guys. But they still don't have the five. They still 5-4. They got when what's her name dies or gets weak or something.
Ginsburg.
Yeah.
This is crafted as an intentional provocation towards Roe versus Wade, and everybody knows it. And
it's real out there. I mean, it's
Yeah. Right. So I guess the voters in South Dakota have a chance now to halt this law if they can collect enough signatures. The law will be delayed. It's scheduled right now to take effect in July. It'll be delayed until November if they can come up with enough signatures. And I'm guessing that they probably won't come up with enough signatures. And this will make its way up the pipeline, and the Supreme Court will hear this case, and then we'll find out what happens.
See, one of the things that's happened in America is there are two major great distractions, and they're both a little bit about sex. The two major great distractions are the question of giving rights, equal rights, to gays and lesbians.
Yeah.
And the other major distraction, perhaps even larger, is the question of women's reproductive rights.
Yeah.
And these distractions, which every good, and I put quotes around it, people like you and I probably, person, are very concerned that these things be enacted, that people get their rights, that they have their reproductive rights, that they have their sexual union rights, and so on. All of that is, and why I call it a distraction, is because meanwhile, in the big game, the fascist thing moves on.
Yeah.
So, but I actually have a question for you, which is maybe a little bit different, which is why? What lies behind this fundamentalist thing about abortion?
All right, well, before I get to that, I think I'm going to have to disagree with you there. I think this question of women's reproductive choice is far more than a great distraction, although it has been used politically as such. The question of women's reproductive freedom really goes to how we define women in the context of our society. Until abortion was made safe and legal and free in this country, or in Western civilization, or anywhere, and it's civilization
anyway.
You
mean free like affordable?
Yeah, free like affordable, and free legally, and so on. Women were defined in no other terms but as childbearers. Either you had children, and you were useful as a woman, or you didn't have children and you weren't. End of story. So now that we have reached a point where our technology, in terms of contraception, and in terms of interrupting a pregnancy, women for literally the first time in history have been able, as a class, to define themselves in terms other than as people who have children. Mm. In other words, they're able to act as men have acted through history.
Mm-hmm.
And the choice of reproductive freedom is integral to this entire concept.
Okay. Actually, I agree with you.
Okay.
We could pretend.
Okay. Now down to your question. Why?
Why?
Why? Because this, it is my position that anti-abortionists, particularly
Christian. Why do they call them? Why do they call them? Actually, it's anti-choice.
Anti-choice.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to call it.
Well.
Particularly anti-choice people of the Christian ilk.
I call so-called Christians.
Right. They're not simply against abortion. I think they are anti-sex and ultimately anti-woman.
Whoa.
Yeah. Note that most anti-choice people, when they talk about the desiring a ban on abortion, will go out of their way to say they'll make an exception in the case of rape or in the case of incest. So I'm forced to wonder, if all innocent life is to be preserved, aren't the children of rape and incest just as innocent as every other fetus?
Well, yeah. In fact, I think the Dakota law, I'm not sure, but I think the Dakota law does not...
No, it doesn't make those exceptions,
yeah.
And it's notable in that respect.
I mean, it's just absolutely, you get pregnant, you bring the baby to term.
But it's the exception in that respect.
Yeah.
When you're talking about a ban on abortion, and when you're talking about overturning Roe v. Wade, you almost always hear that caveat, an exception for rape, an exception for incest. But aren't all those children equally innocent?
Well,
so if you're going to make an exception for those reasons, you're really not... It's really not about the innocence of the child. It's really not about terminating the pregnancy. It's about punishing the behavior of the mother.
Well,
because if a mother has consensual sex for fun or for whatever reason, and she has a baby, well, it's her own damn fault. But if she's raped or she's the victim of incest, well, then we got to terminate that pregnancy because she wasn't really bad. She didn't choose to have sex. She didn't exercise her rights as a sexual being in those cases. She was somebody else's victim.
Well,
so then we can terminate that pregnancy.
Well, here I actually disagree. I think this is a tactic. I think by excluding those two categories, they figure, the anti-choice people, figure that they can get away with this because that's not the woman's fault. It's just a tactic. They really believe that all fetuses are human beings. And beyond that... And this supports your idea about anti-sexuality. These are the people who do not want sex education in the schools, who do not want readily available contraception, who do not want the morning after pill.
No.
Which is not an abortificant, one could point out. It simply brings on a menstrual cycle. All of this, it to me, makes clear that these people really, really, really are against sex, and they believe you can prevent sex. They have an actual 19th century Victorian fantasy about what sex is about. They forget about all the guys who got girls pregnant in the past and ran away.
Yep.
They forget about all the incest that took place in families. They forget about all the foolishness of people, of ordinary people in their sexual lives. They forget about true love. They forget about all the folk music. Yeah, where the lady gets drowned because she's pregnant, whatever. All of that is being forgotten in favor of a mythological notion that young women come to the altar always to the altar, always to be married, otherwise they're, as you suggest, not very useful, come to the altar innocent of knowledge of sexuality.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a weird mythology.
It is. And it is fundamentally, I believe, anti-sex and anti-woman. Because think about it this way. If it was really about protecting the life of the unborn, then fundamentalists who are anti-abortion would encourage just about every sexual activity that doesn't end up in pregnancy. Otherwise, you know, if they truly believe what they said they believe, then you could go to any church in this country and receive detailed instructions on how to do oral sex or any other kind of sex short of intercourse, because they don't lead to pregnancy. But they don't do that. Obviously, why? Because it's about being against sex. It is about denying women their full expression as sexual beings in this culture, because to do so is a challenge to the patriarchal prerogatives that have existed for thousands of years.
You know what creeped me out many, many years ago? I was a student at Reed College many, many, many years ago, and the doctor there and I got in some kind of conversation. He was telling me about how happy he was, how good he felt, and I swear he was, you know, kind of excited about it, to encounter in a pelvic exam a young woman who was a virgin.
Oh!
Yeah, I mean, really sick, strange, strange stuff. And that was the first time, and I was like 18, 19 years old, this is the first time I really encountered the creepiness. This guy was a creep, I think. Mm-hmm. The creepiness of this whole obsession with virginity and with this some kind of, you know, when you get married, then you own each other. Well, you don't own each other. The guy owns the gal.
Right.
See, it's a total possession notion.
Well, absolutely.
And it's all about power. It really is.
It really is all about power, and it's all about archetypes, and it's all about all kinds of things that I'm sure we're going to get into over the next hour here or so.
I just don't know. So what we got on the table here is Bush in New Orleans. We were going to play some New Orleans music, but I guess we're not. and we got lots of calls. We won't probably have time for the port scandal today, but maybe.
Maybe. Well, before we take calls, let me make one more comment on this abortion.
Oh, you can just please go on.
It's worth noting that the most vociferous, the most rabid anti-abortionists out there are men.
Well, duh.
Well, yes. Well, duh. Yeah, they're men.
Yeah.
And it's they're also going around saying that the alternative here is not contraception, or it's not other forms of sex besides intercourse. It is abstinence. Their answer to this, to avoiding pregnancy, is saying don't have sex. Now, this brings up an interesting quandary. I would say to those men, and if there are any men out there listening to this show right now who believe that abstinence is the answer to preventing abortion, I would ask you this. How would you feel about living in a world where the only women who will have sex with you are those who are interested in having a baby as a result? Are you interested in living in that world? Probably not.
Well, how about this? Doing away with automobiles because, you know, cars are opportunity sites.
Well, this is true.
No more dances.
That's true.
Opportunity sites.
Yeah, and following the same logic, you know, bacon is a major cause of heart attacks, so I imagine in the interest of preventing heart attacks, we ought to do away with bacon.
Well, I could handle that.
Oh, well.
No, let me add a couple more things which are really extremely interesting about this. The most of these people actually believe that life begins, that is, a human being is created at the moment of conception. Now, because nobody can see the actual conception process, any woman who has intercourse, who's sexually active with a man, and any woman who does that, a certain percentage, and I think it's like 30%, maybe more, of all conceived foeti, that is to say an egg that's been fertilized, they're not really fetuses, eggs that have been fertilized, do not effectively attach to the wall of the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
They are flushed out in the course of a normal menstrual period. Since each one of those eggs is a human being, if it's a zygote, if it's been fertilized, then I believe that if this is really what they think, they should be required to pay for the funerals of every menstrual cycle of every woman who is sexually active, since they have no way of knowing whether or not that's a human being.
231-8187 is the number to call. We got a lot on the plate today. Who do we have up, Eduardo? Larry, you're up first.
Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Larry.
At least a 2-year-old can run. Bye-bye, the...
What could that mean?
At least a two-year-old,
can run. Oh, I get it, I get it, I get it. See, they're defenseless
In the womb.
In the womb.
Yeah. This poor, huddled
little fetus
collection of dividing cells.
At any stage.
Anna, good morning.
Hello.
I hope this call's better than the last one. Go ahead.
Well, give me a break. Anyway, I know I'm not trying to, somewhat in the dark ages. Well, I went for a short time to Hofstra College, now University of New York, and Hunter College in the city, but I had to drop out for real reasons. But anyway, Abe and Joe, I have to do this. I may not save this country, but I'm calling out to all females from all walks of life. Let's teach each other. Let's learn how to be sisters. We need to do it. We've never done it, sisters.
Do what?
Make sisterhood, know how to support and help each other so that maybe we can save this country from the human devils. Thanks, Abe and Joe.
Thanks, Anna.
I'm not sure what she wants women to do.
Sisterhood.
Well, I'm for sisterhood.
Sure.
You know.
Save us from the human devils.
Well,
we know who they are.
Wait a minute, that's us.
No, it's not.
Oh, okay. All right, 231-8187.
Gordon, good morning.
Good morning. I think men are afraid of women because they can give birth. They're all powerful. I mean,
that's a pretty great power.
It's the biggest power that you have on the planet of the Earth. I mean, there's nothing bigger than to give life. And women are the only people that can give life. And if you've looked through the ages of time, what has man done is suppress and oppress the woman because they're afraid of the woman. And if you look at the Romans and the Greeks, they ended up acting like women and dressing like women because they want to be and have the almighty power. And that is to bring in life. But see, now here's the contradiction. George Bush wants all the almighty power. He's the one that wants to take all life. So
you're saying George Bush is a woman?
He's worse than a woman.
Or he's frustrated
he's
because...
Worse than a woman. Where are we going with this, man? This is
strange. He's worse than ever. He's worse than a woman, man, animal. He's a woman. We must protect. We must help. And we must get these women together, just like the last lady said. We must get these women together to bond together because there's more women than men, right?
Well, what is this we must? I mean, I think that...
We've got to start instigating. We got to start instituting. We start manifesting this reality. We must make this a reality that the women come into power somehow for themselves, because if they don't have the strength, the power themselves, they don't have the strength, the power, a big group of women. So we must start, I guess, on the individual, right?
Well, first of all, I think that the fundamental question of what kind of politics ought to be exhibited by women is really up to women. I also think that women are quite capable of doing the organization. One of the things that has been produced over the last since the 1960s or 70s is real consciousness among a lot of women, particularly in the middle classes and in the upper classes, and to a great extent in the working classes. And I expect that we will see a new rebirth of the women's movement. The problem here is the mystifications of faith and tradition. And these are things that are hard to overcome for anybody, let alone men or women as a separate sexes.
Only because most of those women have been, their self-esteem has been taken away from them and the truth has been denied them. The truth is that they have more power than any man on this planet, and they must exude that power, and they must take control and take a hold of it and use it and wield it to their advantage. And what we have, Code Pink, yes, that's nice, but give me some others. I mean, Joanne Bowman's nice. She's running
Oregon Action.
Oregon Action, and you've got Working America, who is the AFL-CIO, and it's ran by women, and it's called the Pangina Group or something like that is a little nickname that they have for themselves. I mean, we really need to start getting into the school, just like the military does, and start educating these children that have been, held hostage in their home education, I guess.
Okay, enough, I think, for now. Thank you very much for the call. I want to mention that the International Day on KBOO is coming up Wednesday, by the way. That's a thing. But what?
That's a thing. Yes,
it's a
it
thing.
Is.
It's
yes,
an
it
important
is.
Thing. Let's talk about the issues I want to focus in on today. First of all, I am not going to presume to tell anybody of a different class or situation or ethnicity or sexuality or gender what it is that they ought to be doing about these kinds of issues, except to say in very general terms for all of us that destroying the rights of one class of individuals inevitably compromises and destroys the rights of another class
Indeed.
Of individuals. And that is really clear to me on this question of reproductive rights. And I say to anyone who doesn't want to, doesn't believe in abortion, that they ought not to have one.
Yeah, that's about as simply, I think, as it can be stated. All we're saying here is, really, for the first time in history, we have in the industrialized West a state where women can act as men have acted for all of history, and that is to be the masters of their own bodies, of their own destinies, to seek unto themselves education and wealth if they so desire, political power if they so desire. Now, have we reached a state of equity? No, we have not, but we have taken more strides towards equity over the past 100 years than at any other point in all of history. Now, you can point towards a few cultures scattered throughout history where women have wielded power in close approximation to what men have wielded. But I think they're the exception rather than the rule. Patriarchy has been the rule of the day since civilization began, and I think even before civilization began. And I think it's really about, in a patriarchal system, of course, power and property pass through the male heir.
Yes.
And, you know, when it comes right down to it, there's really no way to be absolutely sure who your father is unless you absolutely control the sexuality
Isn't
of women.
Isn't some kind of play by Ibsen or Strindberg or one of those guys?
Unless you absolutely control the sexuality of women, you forbid them to have sex with anybody until they are married to their husband, and then only with that husband. That's the only way that men can guarantee that it is their seed that has taken root. Otherwise, they don't know.
231-8187. Bush in and New Orleans. Bush and giving nuclear technology to India. So his buddies in the nuke industry can make more money, and so that we, you say, can create a natural rival state in the East on our side against China?
Yes.
That's your argument?
Mm-hmm.
The Bort scandal. Bort scandal. We haven't even touched that one.
No.
Boy, oh boy, oh boy. All this and more, and the low ratings of the present administration, and the fact that is, whatever else is happening, it's imperative that people get active, because if they don't, hey... You know.
Yeah.
All right.
231-8187. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. Leah, good morning.
Good morning. This is Leah Maka. Joe and Abe, I wanted to respond to something I think you were talking about, Abe, and talking about the gender issue, the sexuality issue, this mm-hmm. anti-sex. As a woman who has studied this many years, what I have observed and what I see and what I'm learning is that the bottom line here is not so much that this is anti-sex or sexuality per se, but the systems wherever you find them on the globe, the patriarchal systems, are not just about controlling women's sexuality. The bottom line is they are anti-life. They are against life itself, because without sex, there is no life, and women are the only carriers. We have technology in our culture where it's possible to clone, but the reality is it is women who have the ability to hold and carry life. And where women are held in respect and sacredness in that ability, you find a quality of life that is far different than anything we know at the present stage. So I think the real danger here is if we stop at the, looking at it as just anti-sex and against sex, and I do agree with you about if they were really wanting, and I think it's they confirm that if they were really wanting to just control birth, then they would teach people all different forms of how to find pleasure with, you know, without conception. But you're right, that's not the case. History has demonstrated that they have actively destroyed all the medicine the women knew in ancient times and indigenous worlds about how to prevent conception. So it's against life, and life is a celebration, and our sexuality is one of the ways that we celebrate life, and it's one of the most fundamental ways. I'm not just sex and sexual. It's not just something I do. It is who I am. So when you say to me, you may not be sexual, you may not have your sexuality, we have to approve it or control it, then what you're telling me is that I'm not allowed to be the person that I am. And that's my life. That's who I am. That's my essence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's against life itself.
Here, no, here.
So anyway.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're
go.
Welcome, guys. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Right on. well said.
You know, there actually are some statistics of relevance here. In most northern European countries, in fact, in many European countries, the teaching of human reproduction and sexuality are integrated into biology curriculums, which, by the way, are not faith-based, and they're not, what do you call it, intelligent design or some other stupid thing. They're actually acknowledging evolution and so on. In European countries, so this sexuality stuff is integrated into the curriculum from the very earliest years. Contraception is readily available. Abortion is readily available. But interestingly enough, the onset of sexual activity is later than in the United States. The instances of early terminated pregnancies, abortions, are lower than in the United States. The divorce rates are lower than in the United States. In other words, all the things that make for quality of life and responsibility in matters of reproduction are better in societies where there's available contraception and good sex education. So here we are, the least sex educated country in the industrialized world, ignorant as dog do, and here we are having issues about unwanted pregnancy and trying to outlaw abortion. And there they are with systems that work perfectly well, and they actually have fewer abortions.
Yeah.
I mean, duh!
And probably healthier, happier people.
231-8187.
Hypothesizing there. But.
Yeah, and I got to remind people, you're listening to KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Talk Radio with me, Joe Uris, and my bud, Abe Proctor. Want to hear from you. Topics are Bush, New Orleans, abortion, and the doing away of it in South Carolina as a test case to go to the Supreme Court.
South Dakota.
What did I say?
Carolina.
I don't know why I said that. All right.
South Carolina probably soon to follow.
Soon to follow. Right. And India and nuclear proliferation and the president actually violating the law in this nuclear proliferation matter. Hey, well.
You know, if anti-choice people, anti-abortionists were truly what they say they were,
yeah,
then they would have celebrated Bill Clinton as a paragon of virtue.
Because of the dress.
Because it was oral and not intercourse.
We're not going there. 231-8187. Who do we got? Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hello, Joe. Hello, Abe. Yeah, one thing regarding the choice issue. Pennyroyal, as many women know, is an excellent abortive. You have to be a little careful with it.
It's an herb, isn't it? An herb?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I used to go with Pennyroyal, was it?
Pennyroyal is an... pretty effective. But what I'd like to actually address here is the caller before the last one, the gentleman who was such an ardent feminist and so pro-women's rights, and he just wanted to help those little ladies get that power that they deserve. Thanks, sport. I don't need your help. I think that we could change laws and we could make women's reproductive rights part and parcel of the Constitution in a deep sense, and we could level the playing field as much as is, you know, legally, legislatively possible. But there is a certain mindset that I recognize in quite a few men who proclaim themselves to be ardent feminists and true believers in women's rights and the equality of women and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yet their tone is patronizing and condescending in the extreme, and they are utterly unaware of it. I think there are a great many men out there who consider themselves progressive, leftist, liberal, activists, all that sort of thing. And they bought the package, and the package includes equal rights for women. But they may have achieved a certain level of intellectual understanding of those concepts, but they have yet to internalize that that understanding and make it a part of the way they view the world, so that it is an innate response to events in the world.
So you're saying these
I don't think they're aware of the fact that they that their outlook is quite unconsciously and condescending and patronizing. And I see it all the time.
So you're saying these are well-intentioned men who still have a ways to go to internalize these values?
We
lost her.
We lost her. It's our fault.
Sorry about that,
but
Chris.
She was. I think she was actually making a very good point.
Yeah, she was making a very good point.
I think it's an important thing. It's men are in our society generally brought up in a kind of a certain worldview. You may move intellectually into a place where you have an understanding of the concept, for example, of equal rights, but are you emotionally, psychically, even spiritually ready to deal with that, what the requirements of that are?
I've heard the same complaint from African-Americans about well-intentioned white liberals.
Well, there's this great book. In fact, I want to get this woman on the radio. I forget the name of her book, How to Rent a Negro, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really want to have, I really want to invite her to be on our show sometime soon. Let's remember to do that, because it's hilarious and she's right. It is this patronizing sounding stuff. And you see it in race relations, you see it in male-female, you know, power relations. You see it in any kind of relationships where there's inherently power differentials.
So I'd like to explore this a little more, if anybody has some more ideas about how do well-intentioned men internalize these feminist values and not be patronizing, condescending.
Well, you know, this was something that
paternalist.
When the women's movement, which came out of the anger and disappointment of women in the yippee-hippie anti-war days of the Vietnam War era, actually, when the modern feminist movement was born, these kinds of issues played a major role in discussions. In those days in Portland, Oregon, if I may jump historian here for a moment, first we had the Willamette Bridge and then the Scribe newspapers. That place is sort of taken by the Alliance newspaper today, but not quite, and Street Roots and so on. But we had a real and unending, sometimes agonizing, sometimes very funny discussions of these kinds of questions. The problem I have with these discussions, and I think it's fine to have them on the air today, the problem I have with them is that if we get into the construct of the interactions of individuals to build movements, and don't focus on the activities that are necessary now to deal with the oncoming fascism in America, we can end up being very self-indulgent, all of us. And that worries me. It really does. But, on the other hand, if we aren't clear-headed and understand who the hell we are and what the hell we're doing, the problems will persist.
So we shouldn't get caught up patting ourselves on the back for our mutual enlightenment. We should be aware of these fascists who are coming for us.
Well, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
All right, but let's continue the discussion. 231-8187.
Who do we have, Eduardo?
Maybe we just...
LJ.
LJ!
How are you guys?
Good morning, LJ.
What's up? Well, okay.
You tell me.
Okay, just a couple of quick factoids, you guys. Okay, I understand through corporate media, Bob Schieffer, Bush's approval rating is down to 40% in the red states and 34% in the blue states.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two, let's talk a little about New Orleans. FEMA spent $900 million on trailers that were sitting on blocks in Arkansas.
Yes.
That are now starting to sink in the mud and deteriorate, because there's no electricity and there's no water in like New Orleans to hook them up.
Right. Okay. And they're getting moldy.
Right. Okay. Here's the caveat. 60% of those trailers that they bought were not meant to be used in a floodplain.
Great.
Isn't that odd?
Well, it's not surprising at all, given the incompetence. You know, one of the things that characterizes this administration, there are two things. First of all, well, three. First of all, it serves in the interests of a very small number of very wealthy people. Uh-huh. Second of all, it has no regard for American traditions of civil liberties and civil rights and would do away with them. The third thing is, and this fits in with the kind of Hitlerian aspect of it, they're incredibly incompetent.
Is that right?
Yeah, everything.
No, it's true.
Everything
really.
They touch turns to caca.
Yeah, really. Okay, just one more quick thing. All right.
Well, hang on, I got a question for you. So, hang on the line. Go ahead.
One more quick thing.
Yeah.
All right. this whole women's sexuality thing.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm reading this to you from a national magazine. The latest plastic surgery craze is virginity restoration. For
good lord.
For $2,000 to $5,000, surgeons, plastic surgeons, are rebuilding women's hymens, the vaginal membrane that ruptures during intercourse. Most patients are from cultures that expect brides to be virgins. But some women are having the surgery as a romantic gesture to their partners.
Good Lord.
What an awesome gift to give a man in my life who deserves everything, says Jean Yarborough, who wasn't a virgin when she got married. Giving it up to Lewis was the ultimate experience.
That's just too bizarre for words.
Okay, did you have it? You wanted to ask him a question.
Yeah, ask me.
I wanted to ask you, do you know who sold those trailers to the federal government?
Gee, I don't know. Does one of the cabinet members' guys have anything to do with it?
I don't know. That's why I'm wondering.
I actually haven't the foggiest idea.
Well, let me just hazard a guess. Let me just hazard a guess on this. Let me just guess that somehow some firm that has given money to the Republican Party has something to do with these trailers. I'm just going to hazard a guess. Now, I don't know that. I'm just going
to... Joe, corruption?
In
America?
Yeah.
Joe, Abe, 77% of the American public think that corruption, cronyism, and graft is the way business is done in America.
Well, and of course, that's when people have that knowledge, you would think they'd get outraged and offended. But in fact, it's very useful because it allows people to be totally cynical about the ability of government to serve the interests of the people.
Absolutely. I mean, if 77% of the public actually believes this is going on, and they aren't saying anything or doing anything, they obviously think it's fine.
Listen, we're going to give some others an opportunity.
Okay, Groovy, have a great day, you guys.
Thanks a lot, man.
Restoring your virginity surgically?
Don't go there.
That's just too creepy.
It is. I mean, I don't know why. What? Never mind. I know that this was a thing in some parts of Asia a while back. Actually, this surgical process, this plastic surgery. But I'm not sure it's so... I mean, I think that's some kind of little sidebar.
That's a sign of a diseased culture.
Well, it is. But I don't think it's so common. Anyway.
All right. Steve, you're next.
Yes, sir. I've been in favor of legalized abortion since I was, you know, young enough, 13, 14, to think of the issue, and had an interesting experience in college, and I was interested in the philosophy of biology.
Biology has a philosophy?
The philosophy of biology.
Oh.
In other words, it's intellectual roots, things like that,
gotcha.
What's implied by what the practices are, and the history of biology. Actually, at the same school you went to, so I did some of that. And a little side note, though, I had a bad radio, and I didn't hear the story of the doctor. Before I get back to my experience with an abortion clinic, what did the doctor say about...
Basically what he was saying was he was expressing in almost ecstatic terms his pleasure at discovering, in the course of pelvic exams, students at Reed who were women students who were sexually inactive, who were virgins.
And what kind of pleasure did he, like, show?
Well,
So you don't think he was getting gratification that way?
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't go into it in the terms of his own sexuality. I have suspicions. But, he was talking kind of like an aesthetic, a moral thing.
He appreciated it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I see. Okay. I wouldn't call that necessarily creepy, just maybe... It reinforced his value or something like that.
Well, okay, we can be generous. But
Yeah.
By the way, he's long gone from Reed. I don't want to tar Reed with this brush.
As a matter of fact, his family is a wonderful family. They're great people. I don't think that, from what I know of them, I don't think that was at all creepy. I think he just was expressing his appreciation of that. Anyway, I was... really interested in the history, philosophy of biology, and the social sciences in general, just as a general subject. And so, young, impressionable college student, and so I went to one of the abortion clinics, not as a person who was against abortion at all, but just raising the question that, you know, does this, in fact, the way we do it, say anything about our sensitivity towards human tissue. In other words, when a baby's born, for instance, you know, you can be overcome with emotion. They are amazingly emotional creatures the minute they're born. And, you know, I didn't discover that until I had to get over my own male rigidity in life, until I could finally go, whoa, that baby is amazing. I had to get over my jock years and all that kind of stuff, because I used to just think babies were little blobs. And so I went to the little naive Steve here, trotted into one of the abortion clinics and talked to the director, you know, isn't the mechanical way in which we do this symbolic of a mechanical patriarchal society that can just...
Wait a minute, the mechanical way we perform abortions?
Yeah, they're kind of...
Well, you know, there's no way to do it but physically.
Right, well, I meant our attitude towards it, like just blocking it off and being cold about it and just... So forth, but and so
preferable
in other words,
to a coat hanger, I would hypothesize.
Right? No, exactly. But there was kind of a factory atmosphere, and so anyway, she immediately, I mean, not immediately, we didn't want to discuss it too much, but I pretty much got kicked out of there just for raising a philosophical question, and I'm still not opposed.
So what were you? Let me get this straight. Why were you at the abortion clinic?
Because I was interested in. I was interested in the relationship of abortion to the philosophy of biology and how the way we do abortions, the coldness, the callousness, the casualness.
I'm totally, you've totally lost me here. I mean, I don't think anyone gets an abortion for the ecstasy of the experience.
Yeah,
and I don't think anyone is very happy about having to make that decision. There may be a few women who are, but I doubt it, that there are hardly any.
But I didn't hear until 20 or 30 years later, after that experience.
Yeah.
I'd never heard any of the other side. I experienced in the culture at that time as just kind of a procedure, you know, no problem, blam, do it. And in the culture then of the 70s, I never heard of any of the trauma experienced by women. Those stories weren't being told. The emotions felt by women. I had no idea about any of that.
Well, all right. We're going to let him go, and I need to respond a little bit here. First of all, I've known many women, many, many women who have had abortions, both legal and illegal. None of them experienced this as some kind of casual event.
No.
None of them felt that this was a happy moment in their lives. Some felt relief at not having to bring a baby to term, but that's a different question. I want to tell a story here because it's really important to understand. Back in the early 60s, in Portland, Oregon, there was an abortionist up in Seattle. There were two abortionists performing abortions in Portland. I think this was into the 60s, but certainly in the 50s. There was Dr. Ruth Barnett, a book about her abortion practice by Doug Baker, They Cry on My Doorstep, you can get from the library. what she was doing were very safe abortions in a clinic, and she would get busted all the time. The other abortionist was a guy named Buck, and you women set the thing up. The woman met him on a street corner. She got in his car. She handed him money. He took her to a house in somewhere that he had rented in advance. On the kitchen table, he performed his abortions. He did them as D&Cs, dilation and curettage, you know, and used no anesthetics whatsoever. Women had to walk out of the procedure. That's part of the reason why he didn't use anesthetics. I don't think he was a sadist, though he did make very rude remarks to the women. At one point, he got into the newspapers because he went by accident to the wrong house, was performing the abortion on the wrong kitchen table, and the folks came home. He packed the woman's vagina and took her away. This was the condition, and this will be the condition of abortion. Abortion will not stop by making abortions illegal. What will happen instead is you will have tragedies of self-induced abortions, you will have the tragedy of doctors like Buck, you will have a horrible situation, and beyond that, you will have many babies brought to term who will not be properly cared for. So it's real clear. It's real clear. Abortion should be safe. Abortion should be illegal. It should be legal, pardon me. And abortion should be something that people consider very seriously.
Oh, indeed. And the argument tossed up by the right that there's all these women running around who have abortion after abortion after abortion and just don't give a damn.
that's essentially a straw man, or I guess a straw woman in this case. It's just not the case. The vast, vast majority of women who have abortions, and I'm generalizing here, I would wager, face a profound choice, the consequences of which they have to live with for the rest of their lives. So for the right wing to go around saying that there's all these libertine women out there who just don't care, I think that's pretty far off base, and it doesn't give women credit as thinking, feeling human beings.
Absolutely. And I find it very interesting. This guy calls in and says, gee, I was really disturbed by the cold and efficient nature of the process of having an abortion. What is the fantasy here?
I don't know. I mean, you could describe all of Western medicine that way.
Well, yeah, actually. And it is a problem in Western medicine. But I do not think... first of all, I can't imagine as a man walking into one of these clinics to find out how it really is. Well, the only way to do that would be to put him on a table and give him an abortion.
Yeah.
231-8187.
Diana, good morning.
Good morning. Well, there is something men can do to take things into their own hands. In the February Progressive, there was a letter from a woman who had a pretty good idea about men not ejaculating. Can I say that on the radio?
You just did.
well, it's a really good little article, which I would love to read you a little bit of, but it does have that word in it. So
okay, that's all right.
That's a real question.
Yeah, as long as you use clinical terms and don't describe explicit sexual acts too deeply, as it were.
And as long as you don't enjoy yourself. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, they're saying no one can doubt that sperm are these energetic little swimmers and that they're alive, and the sperm's sole purpose in life is to penetrate an egg, which can then grow from a group of cells into a viable fetus. So this is, every sperm is precious, which if you know your Monty Python is pretty good.
Right. Every sperm is
sacred. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So causing sperm to be ejaculated means sure death to millions of sperm and should not be tolerated except for the sole purpose of being used for procreation. Any man desiring to ejaculate will have to file for a permit and show evidence that his wife is expected to ovulate. Those couples that have all the children they want, or those in which the wife is beyond childbearing age, and any man who has no wife will be denied an ejaculation permit. Eligible men will be allowed to ejaculate only when a commitment to parenthood has been signed. This could prevent 99.999% of all abortions. I'm sure that the pro-life Wisconsin's legislative director, Matt Sandy, would want to be the first to submit to this requirement. His group and the American Life League could set an example for the rest of the population and put a stop to the to ejaculation by choice.
Well, wait a minute. What is the? I like it, but I find that what is the? Will then every male at the onset of adolescence have a spigot or that's locked with a little lock by the state, or what's the deal?
Well, maybe they'll have to. I don't know. I don't know how. You know, it could be legislated since
I imagine a little silver lock. You know, that you have to show.
That's
short
good.
Arm inspection.
I don't know. All I can say is that I've been guilty of genocide since I was 13.
See?
And I'd feel horrible.
Abe, we don't want to hear this. We really don't want to hear about this.
Yeah, they could live up to it, live up to their
Thank you very much for that.
That was very funny. Thank you.
No, it's a great suggestion.
It is. Well, it goes.
No,
back.
It's not. I don't like
it. Goes back to what I said earlier. I said,
what about gay guys? Can they ejaculate?
Well, that's a whole thing. All these men are going around railing against abortion. Do they really want to live in a world where women will only have sex with them if there's babies involved?
No, because there's whores.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry.
See, you got to understand the whole status of women that their society would have. Fallen women.
Well, yeah, right.
Fallen.
Well, I mean, the patriarchy has constructed a couple impossible archetypes that women can live up to.
Whore and mother.
Whore and mother.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to somehow be both at the same time, like Mary was.
Mary?
The impossible archetype. The woman who was both a virgin and a mother.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Mary. Cool dude.
Right, right.
Cool dame.
The unattainable ideal. That's what all you women should be.
Stop it.
Okay.
231-8187. We seem to be stuck, as it were, on the abortion.
Yeah, I knew this would happen. But listen, here's how it is. In my estimation, there's been no better time or place in history to be a woman than right now in the United States of America. And if the right to free and legal abortion is taken away, that is a step backwards. So the 75% of Americans who are in favor of safe, legal abortion believe in going forwards. And this is a small minority of Americans who are trying to shut down all the progress that we've made over the last 150 years in this regard.
Why do you hate America so much?
I don't know.
All right. Who do we have?
Del.
Del. Hi, Del.
Hi there, Joe. Hi, Abe. I just wanted to say I didn't hear this last little piece because I was coming into work, but I do think you gave that guy short shrift who was trying to say that it, in his experience, he had some questions 30 years ago about how abortion clinics were run, and I think that's a valid point. I think it has to be done carefully and thoughtfully and respectfully.
Agreed.
Well, I agreed, but I'm not sure that they aren't. I mean, I know.
Well, no, I'm not sure they aren't either, but it's and I have done abortion counseling, and I've been in the room with numbers of women who were having abortions
uh-huh.
when I was doing that counseling, and we tried to do the best that we could, but I think, you know, still I didn't want you to give his thoughts short shrift because I think he was trying to understand something and he was
I think you're right. I think to some extent I personally just responded to the idea of some guy walking into an abortion clinic and making an appraisal of their practices.
Well, I don't know what it, you know, who knows if we were there how the mood would have been, but anyway, that's all. But you know, on to Bush and those guys, you know, keep up the pressure. They're a bunch of criminals. We've had a bunch of criminals running the country before that, but he's one of the worst criminals.
Well, he's clumsy and fascistic as well as a criminal.
And so he's asking for more and more power, you know, like this line item veto, which
right.
is just, you know, beyond belief, although there's plenty of horrible stuff to veto as far as the way that, the budget process is used. But you can see what he's doing with the power he's amassed, and he certainly didn't use it to respond to Katrina or Rita. So
yeah,
get the bum out. You know, let's impeach him.
All right, thanks a lot for the call.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Del.
Yeah. I'm not going to say another word on this abortion clinic thing. I don't know how you could put together the ideal environment for the destruction of a fetus. I mean, I don't see that there's any. You can and should offer counseling to people. You can, which places do. You can and should offer as comfortable and painless as possible a process.
Sure,
which they do.
Hello.
Oh, you're on the air. Hi, who are you?
Yeah, this is Helen.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just listening on the way to work, and I thought I'd mention something on the South Dakota abortion. I guess you're still talking about it because I'm not listening to my radio right now.
Yeah, we are.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to point out was that I think the labels are really important. I think you've been calling, you know, the one movement the anti-abortion and one the pro-choice, but I think it's really important to remember that that one group calls themselves pro-life and the other one pro-choice. And I think that's really important on this day of, you know, labeling and
mm-hmm.
choice of words because, okay, so what are you? You're pro-life or you're anti-life, you know, and
that's a good point. That's really a good point. I think the labels really should be pro and anti-choice.
Right. And but they've already caught this. They've got pro-life. They're the pro-lifers and the other group is the pro-choices. So it's like even at that stage they've put themselves, you know, like a couple of rungs higher on the, you know, the moral. I guess that's my point, you know.
It's they've seized the moral high ground.
Choice is not as important as life.
No, I think your point is really good, and the fact that they've effectively grabbed the semantic high ground, is an important thing, and it's a psychologically telling thing. And for young people in our society who actually come up thinking of reproductive rights as rights, you know, they may not realize the implications of what's going on at this point,
right.
And they're hearing this constant barrage of propaganda from the anti-choice people.
Right. Well, yeah, anyway, so I just thought I'd mention it because, yeah, it sort of does make a difference and it sort of sets a different tone when you're discussing it when you're out there, you know, and even the signs, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, you know, who's exactly right. I mean, who's morally, you know, up there and who's just trying to make choices for your life or whatever. Well, anyway, I just wanted to mention that and thanks for your show.
You bet.
Okay.
Thanks
a lot
for the call. Now, she's making a really important point.
Yes, she is.
Control the language, you control the discussion.
All right. So, are we agreed on anti-choice and pro-choice?
Anti-choice, right. Pro-choice. That's, I think, true
yes.
and adequately descriptive.
Yes, indeed.
So let's make a rule if we can remember. That's a good rule. She made a really good point. 231-8187. We seem to be talking a lot about the issue of what happened in South Dakota.
Well, it's pretty important.
I know, it is important.
And it will find its way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Pray for Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah. It's interesting. We were talking earlier about why does the South Dakota law not include exceptions for cases of rape and incest? And probably, I'm thinking, the crafters of this law intended it to go before the Supreme Court, and they intend for it to be rejected by the Supreme Court, and they intend that an opinion be written by Supreme Court justices saying that this is too much, but they might leave the door open for a ban on abortion that includes exceptions for rape and incest. So they might be doing this simply to stake out the appropriate territory for laws across the nation.
Sort of an acceptable compromise. I put quotes around the word compromise.
Exactly. They're overshooting the mark so that eventually they can get what they want.
You know, I think you're right, actually. It's scary. 231-8187?
Chuck, good morning.
Hey, I'd like to make a remark about the abortion debate and then just make another remark about the left. And are you there? Do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you're on the air. Be careful what you say.
I will be careful. Thank
Homeland
you.
Security will come and get you if you say the wrong thing.
So here it is. One of the things that I'm not sure that this abortion debate is, or the issue of abortion can ever be compromised, or there could ever be a reconciliation between opposing sides on this issue. But one thing that I think that people on the right feel upset about with lefties who are pro-choice, or call them, the libertarians, is really it's a libertarian issue. And it's around that there's a perception that there's no reverence. That they're too irreverent. They don't feel any awe for life itself. Now, I want to just acknowledge that I consider myself essentially pro-life because I do value the planet, I do value life, and I want to end poverty and all those traditional things. But so that's part of the rub. But I'm just wondering if some dialogue could be generated around questions of reverence, the philosophical idea, the virtue of reverence. So don't remark if you want to. I just want to make a remark, and I'm going to hang up and listen. But to pick up on the point that caller made just a moment before, this whole language, this whole issue of semantic, and Michael Lerner yesterday raised it, and George, is it Lakoff or Lakosh? Lakoff?
Lakoff.
Lakoff.
Lakoff, the guy from UC Davis, I think, who's basically telling lefties, spin your rhetoric so it has a positive language and not a negative rhetoric. Stop calling Americans who don't agree with you stupid, and again, get more dialogic in your discourse so that you don't alienate but you embrace. And my question to you guys is, is there merit to this kind of thing, or is it just kind of a magical thinking that if we change our language and our rhetoric that somehow we're going to build a movement? You know what I'm saying?
No, I think you're raising a really, really important point.
Okay, I'm going to hang up and just please remark, and then I enjoy your day. Bye-bye.
Yeah. First of all, on the question of this, of the issue of reverence, I think that how people view their own reproductive process is a personal matter. It has to be a personal matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people who do not think that abortion is right should not have abortions. And of course, we're only talking about women here now. And I want to be clear about that. And I think that it's really, if men don't want there to be abortions, they have to be careful not to have sexual intercourse with women and ejaculate.
Yes.
I mean, that's their responsibility.
We haven't touched on.
That's a simple responsibility. Yes. Don't do it if you don't want that issue to happen, because that's where thereof the issue comes.
Right. Wear a raincoat when it rains, damn it.
Okay, enough of that. But now the more interesting issue to me is the question of whether or not there's a problem of the rhetoric of the left vis-a-vis the popular rhetoric of America. This is the Lakoff thing. And it's a very, I didn't mean to prepare to talk about this today, but it's a very, very interesting idea. I think that it is magical thinking to a great extent. That is, that if we just could frame the debate in terms that would please everybody, then and still keep our positions, then everything would be cool. The fact of the matter is that no matter how we frame our debates, the bottom line is that there's a set of people, and I would guess it's about maybe 30% of American activists, active voters, and so on, who would never fall for that. They simply are in the positions they are, and they will reframe the rhetoric. No matter how we change the rhetoric, they will reframe the rhetoric in their own favor. On the other hand, there is a tendency within the left to use a specialized left language, which does isolate and does alienate large numbers of Americans. So one of the things I think is important is plain talk, and also careful talk. So those are the two things that I think respond to that appropriately. And we must never get caught in the defensive language that so often we hear from liberals and leftists.
Yeah, I think I think that's the key right there. I think it could be as simple as quickly and unconditionally refuting the manner in which the right frames the debate. For example, the next time you hear, "Why do you hate America so much?" immediately say, "I don't hate America so much. I love America, or I wouldn't be having this conversation with you."
Right.
The tendency, I think, especially on part of the Democrats, is to become immediately cowed by the rhetoric of the right and backpedal and say, "Oh, no, that's not what I mean, that's not what I mean." Instead of staying right up in these people's faces, immediately refuting what they're saying and stating why.
And, of course, this is all very difficult because we have had, from 1940 on, a kind of military-industrial complex-dominated discourse. All of the media is basically in the hands of the same bunch of people, the majority of the media, stations like this being notable exceptions, but relatively small audiences. We have had a discourse that is dominated by a kind of nationalist, prideful, fake, really, kind of Americanism. And that has gone on and on and on and on. And it's really hard to counter that. So when Lakoff and Michael Lerner and so on say, "Hey, we should talk a different kind of talk," how exactly do you talk a different kind of talk without talking the talk you really need to talk? I'm not sure that's possible.
You start by immediately refuting them. They say, well, don't you support the troops? Well, yeah, I support the troops. I want them to come home alive and uninjured as soon as possible. That's how I support the troops. It's not backing down. That's the key.
I think this is a topic we should save for
yes,
another time.
I think so.
Because it's really complex, and it's very, very interesting.
Charlie, you're next. Good morning.
Charla. And I certainly lots of things have come up here to think about. I actually would, and some of the things that I was thinking about have been brought up, but I would like to go back to the issue of talking carefully and thinking carefully and specifically thinking things out. And the use of language, if you're going to start talking about that, the abortion debate, in quotes, is really a good example of how pro-choice is a very specific and carefully thought out understanding use of language about whether or not people can make the choice of that is based on their beliefs and their needs. And the pro-life has actually ended up dominating the debate. It didn't matter that it was carefully thought out and carefully chosen language. And a perfect example of how the pro-life has dominated the debate and perverted and turned it into debate that's actually a perverted debate is the well-meaning person who called up earlier talking as accepting, first of all, saying there were two sides. There are not two sides to the issue. He actually had accepted that there were two sides and is starting to talk in terms of what the other side said rather than thinking out the whole situation and the whole issue. Making assumptions of that there was not reverence for life on the pro-choice side, and also making assumptions that what the other side said about how traumatic and how difficult abortions are, you know, as if that's something that doesn't have a range of realities depending on the people who are involved. And the kind of situations they're in and the kind of choices they're in, and that there certainly is reverence for life on the side of the people who are pro-choice. And There also are many people who make choices that they wish they didn't have to make, but that seem that are the best choice at the time, that is not callous, but it's also not traumatic. As studies have shown that in most cases it is not traumatic. So I just wanted, you know, I just like to bring it back to like thinking things through carefully and understanding the whole situation rather than these arbitrary sides that end up being created by, I believe, the right wing.
Yeah, I agree that we need to be very careful in our choice of language, and I agree that we need to be very thorough in our thinking about this issue. But when you get down to brass tacks, as much as you claim that the anti-choice side of this story has dominated the debate, nonetheless, 3 out of 4 Americans believe that abortion should be available and legal and safe. So, you know, maybe the anti-choice side has been effective rhetorically, but the majority of Americans disagree with that position in the end.
I understand that, and I agree. Since we're just talking about the debate, that's the issue I was addressing. I understand that, and I just to help keep things in perspective, I'd like to add a little anecdote that I just actually heard from one of the activists in South Dakota who passed this recent. He was actually a legislator who was one of the people who passed the new anti-abortion law. And his ideal is to go back to the good old days where women are virgins and that they and the men are forced to marry the women if the women get pregnant. But essentially, and he's setting this up as some kind of ideal. And what the implications are of that, some people may not know, but are just horrendous in terms of double standards,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
all those kind of things, and women being in their place. But anyway, I'll leave. But I just it just blew me away when that was seen as the good old days. But some people seem to think so.
Right, thank you for the call, Charlotte.
Yeah,
that double standards you touched on is underlying much of what's going on here today, and that double standard persists today. What do you call a man who has had a lot of sexual partners? You call him a real man. He's virile. He's a stud. And what do you call a woman who has had a lot of sexual partners? She's a slut. She's a whore. We need to do away with that double standard, and that would get us a long way.
I think part of the problem that the a lot of this right-wing stuff is essentially a reaction to changing times and changing situations and to what is perceived as if you empower women, you disempower men. I just really want to do some business here. First of all, I want to remind people you're listening to KBOO 90.7 on the FM dial. This is Talk Radio with Abe Proctor, Joe Uris. I'm Joe Uris. At 9 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Marion Barasinic speaks with Cheryl Strayed, an award-winning Portland writer whose first novel, Torch, is about love, loss, and redemption in a working-class family. At 9:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Kimberly Lawson Roby, author of 7 novels, including the latest, Changing Faces. At 10, Per Ferring interviews filmmaker Mark Manning about his documentary, Caught in the Crossfire, The Untold Story of Fallujah, which is a very important film, by the way. You know, Americans don't know the horrors of what went on in Fallujah. And if you don't understand the kinds of stuff that actually goes down in this war in Iraq, the murderous stuff that we engage in, our nation actually engages in our name, you can't really understand the kinds of reactions that take place. At 10:30 on stage and studio, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts an interview with members of Oregon Children's Theater production of The Giver. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, the topics are secret deals intended to provoke war in Iraq, British soldiers' refusal to fight in Iraq, and an interview with Christian peacemaker teams. All that and more on your listener-supported radio, KBOO 90.7 on the FM dial. Right now, back to Talk Radio and perhaps to the callers. Let's go to Kurt.
8187. Kurt, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm calling in to check in from the other side with you guys.
Oh, good.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm on the pro-life side.
The anti-choice side. Go ahead.
Well, you know, that's a that I think strikes right to the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
Is I'm not interested in, I've heard a lot of the women talking about that they would be subjugated and put back in you know, that we're going to go back to the 17th century or something along those lines. First off, I engaged in plenty of premarital sex. I don't consider it any of my business who they sleep with or don't sleep with or what they do sexually. And there's a tubs of us out here that are opposed to abortion as birth control who feel the same way and would be more than happy to pay for government-financed birth control and tubal ligations, if that's the thing, because we're not the least bit interested in dominating women or telling women what they can do with their bodies. But we truly believe that life begins at conception and that ending life simply to not suffer the inconvenience of being pregnant and raising a child is not something that we want to be involved in. Lots of us are interested in seeing Roe v. Wade overturned because it'll throw it back to the states, which will then give the states the ability to choose and let people live in an environment that more closely meets their moral standards.
Why not just throw it back to the neighborhood? Let each neighborhood decide.
Well, that's what we have states for. I mean, that's your, and if, and let me just point out a little thing in your logic here. If 3 out of 4 Americans favor abortion on demand, what are you worried?
I'm worried about, Kurt, well, let me address a few of your points in turn here. I'm worried about a small vocal minority imposing their moral framework upon the rest of the country and revoking what is now a constitutionally protected right. Now, getting back to your other points, I think you hold a far more enlightened position than many people on the anti-choice side of this issue, in that you are in favor of free and easy access to contraception. There are a lot of abortion opponents. In fact, I go so far as to say the majority of abortion opponents who are vocal about the issue are also opposed to contraception. Why? Because they're not just anti-abortion, they're anti-sex, as I said in the beginning of this show. So I wish, Kurt, that a lot more of the anti-choice side of this equation held your view. I think we'd be in a lot better position. Now, if with regard to the states' rights issue, I think that's a non-starter. That was the same argument used by segregationists, saying it's a states' rights issue. That was code for, let us be as bigoted as we want in this state. The reason why we can't throw this to the states is because this is a fundamental right about sovereignty over a woman's body by her own choice, and that has to be a universal right available to every woman in every state, and to throw it back to the states is to take a step backward, just as it would have been to do the same for the segregationists.
So the unborn child has no rights?
No, the unborn child doesn't have any rights. We chart life in this country at birth. My birth date is listed on my birth certificate. I don't have a conception certificate. I was allowed to drive a car 16 years after my birth. I was allowed to drink alcohol 21 years after my birth, not after my conception. And is this a cold, hard calculus? Perhaps it is. I believe that the rights of an expectant mother trump that of the collection of cells growing in her womb.
Well, then you and I have a different definition.
Well, I'm interested in exploring this just for a moment with you, because I think it's very interesting. So you really believe that the minute a zygote is created, that is, an egg and a sperm have united, that is actually a human being?
I believe that it is a, how do I put this? I believe that life is a gift from God.
Okay, that's
and that's not up to your, how do I put it, it's not open your examination, just as your having that belief or not having it is not open to mine.
Yeah, but let's get practical here, because
it's not negotiable.
Well, wait, you're talking about a very practical issue as well as a mystical issue. I don't have any argument with you mystically, and I certainly think that people who think abortion is wrong shouldn't have abortions. That's not my point. My point is simply this. When you have said that life begins at conception, and I'm asking you, do you really believe that?
Well, no, I don't. If I said that, then I misled you.
So when does life begin, then? Have you fixed a time?
I have not. I have thought about this. First off, I was once pro-abortion, or once didn't care. You know, I can't get pregnant, so what do I care?
You mean pro-choice, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, but, and it has taken me a long time and a lot of thought and a lot of soul-searching to get to the position that I have today. So the bottom line on it is, my logic for myself is, if I believe that, you know, that life comes from God and it's a gift from God, and I believe that, when does this life begin? You know, when does consciousness begin? When does life begin? When is it actually there? I don't know, and I haven't heard any scientific.
But why then?
Proof.
But wait, well, why then set a? If you don't know clearly, and I'm not putting you down for not knowing clearly. I don't know that anyone knows clearly. If you don't know clearly when it is a separate entity, this fetal material, this zygote, whatever,
right,
then how can you decide on the day or date from which it is a killing of a human being or the not killing of a human being?
What I came down to is, since I can make no clear decision, is I'm going to err on the side of the angels rather than be wrong and condone the killing of innocent children. Then I've got to oppose it from the beginning, because I can't give a definite point.
But you did say that you didn't think an early zygote is a person.
But then you also asked me if that zygote has rights. So which is it?
Well, actually, you were earlier in the discussion, you were talking about eggs that don't get implanted. Okay. Eggs that don't get implanted.
Well, sometimes they get implanted, and, you know, going to a mystical place for a moment, which I don't generally do, and God sees that those particular eggs are going to produce very twisted, messed up, three-headed creatures, and decides to flush them.
I don't think God works that way.
Well, I don't know how God works, if indeed there is a God. I think what we're getting into, and this is my point, is a very mystical discussion about a very real issue.
You're using the word mystical. I look at it this way. I believe that the planet that I live on, the body and that I inhabit, and the mind and the spirit that I have are given to me to do something with. That I need to be a good steward of all of those things, and that I need to make up my own mind about what I consider to be right behavior and bad behavior, and that in the end, I'll have to answer to someone higher than myself for that.
It's a very good thing, then, that you are never going to be forced to make the choice about whether or not you should have an abortion.
Well, I didn't say that a woman who has an abortion is an evil person.
Okay.
That's your terminology.
No, I don't think I said that.
Listen, I've done plenty of things where I knew I shouldn't do them and did them anyway, and suffered guilt, and I'm not blameless, okay?
Hey, Kurt, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut this off. We're running out of time. I do appreciate your call. It was nice that we had somebody from the anti-choice side give us a call. Any further comments, you can email them to joeandabe@yahoo.com. And that's it. Yeah.
Hey, listen, all the issues I wanted to talk about today, we hardly did it all, but it's okay. We can live with that.
All right,
this
is
an important issue.
See you next week.
Yeah, we will.
I bet you $5 you're not gonna listen.
Giacomo Finale.
Talking about henna.
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 Michael.
Giacomo Fino. Anani. Giacomo Finale.
Girl all dressed in blue.
I go one day.
Well, she won't, but they say her sister do.
Giacomo Fina, hey.
Talking about hey now.
Hey now.
Hey now.
Hey now.
I go
one day. Giacomo
Fina. Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. First on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews Bernard-Henri Lévy, author of American Vertigo, A Frenchman in Search of America. The interview with author Cheryl Strayed, whose first novel is titled Torch, is unavailable, and we will try to air it at a later date. At 9:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Kimberla Lawson Roby, author of seven novels, including the latest, Changing Faces. At 10, Parafoggering interviews filmmaker Mark Manning about his documentary, Caught in the Crossfire, The Untold Story of Fallujah. At 10:30, on stage and studio, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts an interview with members of Oregon Children's Theater's production of The Giver. And at 11, on Democracy Now!, the topics are secret deals intended to provoke war in Iraq, British soldiers refuse to fight in Iraq, and an interview with Christian peacemaker teams. Now let's go to Between the Covers.